is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Harlem Venison. Harlem, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you, Robert. I'm very happy to be on the show with you.
And I'm also joined here with Alex von Goldstein.
What's going on, guys? And Harlem or Al? It's
Harlem, Al, yeah, whatever.
It's great to speak with you. I've been checking you out on YouTube for a couple months now, and I am fascinated by your videos. And I'm very perplexed by you on many levels, and I just kind of want to figure out who you are and where you come from and what you're all about.
Thanks, man. I'm flattered. You want me to tell you?
Well, you have two books out, which we can discuss. Lowell, A Racist in Exile, which is a book of poetry, and your other novel, which is just got released, is called A Death to the World. I think a good way to start out is, can you kind of tell us your life story?
Yeah, so I was born in 1987 in New Hampshire. I remember when I was 3 years old, I sleptwalked out of the house during a snowstorm and across the street, and my parents didn't find me until I was already like in the snowy forest. So my life story, let me think, how can I summarize it? Basically, for most of my life, I've been a very conscious racist, sort of fundamentally opposed to the anti-racist, moral power structure of our era. And I've been basically trying to apply myself toward the end of, bringing it down.
What is conscious racism?
By that, I mean, like, I was red-pilled at a very, very young age simply by observing the world around me. It's not like, you know, what I'm saying is, like, my entire being, my entire identity is built around doing whatever I can to try to end anti-racism.
So what is your... Racism is a, you know, kind of a complicated...
Weasel word.
Yeah, it's a complicated subject. You know, people mean different things when
yes.
they call someone a racist, you know.
Yeah, so I wear the badge proudly, you know, for the sake of solidarity with people whose lives have been ruined by anti-racism. But I don't... for me, I'm trying to maybe reappropriate it because I see myself as a bleeding heart racist. You know, I see anti-racism as an evil, delusional ideology, which is bad for everybody.
So you're almost like an anti-racist racist.
I'm an anti-racist racist. although honestly, like I feel like I refer to that which we oppose as anti-racism, not so that we call ourselves anti-racist. But so that maybe, you know, a new word can emerge. So it's a constructive, positive ideology against a negative ideology, anti-racism.
Did you have sort of some, like, experiences in your life that shaped your opposition to this anti-racist ideology?
To be honest, like, I've maybe a little bit here and there, but like I said before, for me, we're just sort of observing what is, to be honest, it's fucking obvious, man. Like, the emperor wears his no clothes. You know, the theory of racial equality is obviously bullshit. Everyone knows it. It's an open secret. So for me, it's just like, you know, it's you know, my whole life, it's been pretty obvious that this is a divisive, unsustainable ideology which stokes human suffering for everybody.
So you want to basically make it okay to be racist in order to end the kind of like moral panic of anti-racism? This idea like people can get
Alex,
along if everyone's racist or something like that?
Sure, maybe. Alex, what are you trying to say?
I'm just sort of trying to figure out where what this ideology is in a way. because
anti-racism.
Well, I know what that is, but it seems like you're taking a phrase that a lot of people use as an insult, and you're taking it and you're making it into something positive. So I want to know what you mean for that for yourself, because basically everyone who hears you, who's not clued into the kind of stuff we talk about on here, is going to hear you say, I'm a racist, I'm opposed to anti-racism, and just think that you're like a bigot. And that's where I'm sort of getting at.
First of all, I'm fundamentally, intrinsically racist, but I am totally opposed to bigotry. That's one thing I do not aspire to be. I do not want to be a bigot. I am a racist. And what I'm saying, I guess, is that I think that for me, I see, you know, communism and, you know, radical empathy and what, like, cosmic oneness as perhaps an end product of human evolution. But, you know, I like to say that, you know, you can't land on the moon with bad science. And the way we're trying to build this, you know, utopia, we're doing it on a shoddy foundation, you know, on loose soil. The theory of racial equality is pseudoscientific. It's obviously false. And you can't use bad science and, you know, build a perfect world.
Sure, sure. No, I definitely see where you're coming from. So did you have this, you're saying you had this from an early age. Did you get flack in middle school and high school for thinking this way?
No, I mean, I never had, I've had a few run-ins with people of color, which have sort of corroborated my worldview, but it wasn't really, I think it's important to be dispassionate if you want to change the world. And for me, it's like, I just sort of been doing this because it's sort of my calling, I guess, my life purpose, my career. I'm not angry per se at people of color or at, you know, the anti-racist fat cats.
So you're more opposed to the ideology than opposed to certain races. Is that what you're getting at?
Fundamentally, yes.
So your book, A Racist in Exile, I was looking over your book of poetry, but my honest take on it is you do use a lot of racial slurs in it, but I don't really see race as a main theme. I see the main theme as more about alienation and being in exile in society.
Yes, very, very good question. Okay, so I recently got a YouTube video deleted by the political correctness Gestapo, and that video was called Nigger Speak Meditation. And in the video, I made a pretty sincere, earnest disclaimer that I did not intend any malice against anybody. But, you know, to use these words, these racial slurs, it's for me sort of a celebration of unfettered, free-flowing, like a speech. Because, I mean, for me, I don't want to offend people when I use the word nigger, for example.
Why do you refer to yourself as the final Negro on your YouTube profile?
I will get to that in a second. I got an answer for that. But anyway, so like the word nigger, for me, it's more of a statement, not against black people, but a statement against anti-racism, because they use this as a mechanism of control. If we're unwilling to say the word nigger, then we're unwilling to criticizing anti-racism, and we're unwilling to try to break the chains of it. And final Negro,
it's
why do I call
kind,
myself?
Kind of ironic, because it's kind of like when blacks started calling each other nigga, it was a way to kind of eliminate, they wanted to eliminate the power of the word, but in a sense, you're kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, exactly. Sure. You definitely say that. Yeah, I call myself Final Negro. It was sort of a poetic and actually a philosophical trope that I've had. Like in maybe a month, I'm going to be releasing, after I'm done promoting my novel, I'm going to be releasing a collection of my three plays called For Speeches at the Gallows. And one of them, it's about a white racist schizophrenic at, of all places, Rutgers University. And
my alma mater.
Gateway to hell. But basically, long story short, like he makes a speech at the end, a like a monologue, explaining that, you know, like humanity is evolutionarily heading towards being abstract minded, believing in false things like God or anti-racism, and that, you know, there's always going to be a small minority of people who see the empirical reality for what it is, like, for example, the reality of race, and such a person will be sort of the umbilical cord which feeds objective reality to humanity, and he will be persecuted and crucified and, you know, maligned anyway. So I see myself in that sense as the final Negro, or among the final Negroes.
Now, a lot of these videos you make, it seems, and this is something I really like about you, and it's like a perplexing mm-hmm. thing, and in a way, I kind of don't even want to ask, because I don't even want to know, but you're
I
on.
Hear it, man.
Let me ask. No, because I don't want it to be spoiled. I don't want the truth to spoil my my kind of fantasy.
I'm very good at giving elusive answers, so I won't spoil anything.
Well, you know, most of your videos, and we'll link to it this in the summary of our chat at the bottom. Most of your videos are you walking around these pretty scenic European locales. You're backpacking through mountains, and you go on these sort of long hallucinogenic rants about race and homosexuality, and there's this video you have that really just blew my mind when I watched it. You're laying down in a field with your backpack, and you're talking about refugees and migrants, and this, it sort of warps with the viewer's conception of what's going on, because, you know, we see all these migrants in that same situation you're in, but you're there too. Like, you're like a migrant in your own, in your own regard. And you're talking about how you got raped by a black trucker at American Renaissance in 2013, and you now have AIDS, and you're giving AIDS to refugees.
And okay, Robert, before I answer, Robert, do you want to add to the question before I answer?
Was it really a question, or Alex was asking you to explain your story about your interactions with migrants?
Okay, so first of all, I will neither confirm nor deny anything. That said, like, you know, a big part of my shtick is, and I say this all the time, but to elude categorization, you know, if you're saying something radically new, and I think what I'm saying is somewhat interesting, you must present yourself in a way that defies categorization. You have to prompt and provoke people to try to assess you in pure form. And so therefore, I try to scramble signals a little bit, and I say a lot of crazy fucking shit. To get attention, because honestly, like, my views on YouTube spike when I piss off the 1488ers.
I'm reading your work, you piss off everyone. You piss off anti-racist SJWs, but you also piss off the 1488ers and, like, traditionalist conservatives. It's like, you're the kind of person, and I think there's very few in this day and age who offends everyone who's an equal offender.
Well, Al was advocating for open borders on another video.
Okay.
So it's, I mean, that's...
Honestly, I say absurd things. I sort of have Tourette's in certain ways. I have a very perverse, verbal streak in me sometimes, especially when I'm in a sort of bizarre state out in the woods or on the highways. But honestly, like, I'm an extremely serious person, and a lot of my humor sort of arises when I'm confronted with people who I think are utterly, fantastically unserious about fucking life and reality and the human condition. So, for example, my videos, they're sort of very starkly divided between extreme seriousness and earnestness and sincerity. And
well, I even saw that with your video about the migrant and the HIV and the black trucker. Like, you went back and forth between humor and talking about, like, trauma. Like, to the audience, it could be, like, kind of confusing.
Yes. I hope it provokes people to try to ask even more questions. All I want, honestly, is people to ask me questions. But so with open borders, I was talking recently on the trigger warning Facebook group with a person named Dia Barghay or something. I forget exactly. But I am actually kind of pro open borders. Like, literally.
And what's your reasoning for that?
Two things. First of all, I think the fundamental core problem of our era is the all that derives from the theory of racial equality. So I think that strategically it makes sense to ignore everything else, regard it as moot. And whatever, all we have to do is convince people to dump this, you know, pseudoscientific theory. And so open borders, that question is derivative. It's not primary. And second of all, I feel that in the future, borders are going to disappear and that new, there'll be perhaps cultural Himalayas, cultural walls, allowing people to, you know, self-aggregate as they desire through perhaps laissez-faire apartheid.
So basically what you're on this show, sometimes we sort of advocate this kind of, what do we call, what is it in the Switzerland, Robert? What are they called? Cantons.
Oh, this was Canton.
Yeah, so we, like, you know, like, I'm an anti-state thinker, you know, Treaty of Westphalia, 1648 and all this stuff.
Sure.
And I think that the state as it exists now is an archaic institution.
Yes.
And does need to die out. But I am also a believer in nations of people, whether those are biological nations or ideological nations. And I think people,
would they be along geographical lines?
Well, I mean, it's sort of like a weird philosophical question, because, you know, you have the internet and all these other ways that people can relate with one another. But I'm interested in, like, the state as it stands kind of dissolving. Like, I have anarchistic views about that, but I also do believe that people should exist within some kind of structure or nationhood amongst people they choose to be around.
Yes, and, it's natural.
You know, however they choose to define that. So, I mean, I guess I agree with you, but for me, it's just, I don't want to say I advocate open borders, because it just throws me in a camp with a ton of people I disagree with and who have ideological purpose. You know, they want open borders for the
moral
state
signaling.
And the state apparatus just to get, you know, more and more worker bees
votes
to
or something.
Yeah.
You were involved with this organization, not really an organization, but kind of an online movement called Gangster Bolshevism. And Gangster Bolshevism, I wouldn't describe it so much as a political ideology, but it's more just about a movement about disrespecting society. There's a little bit, would you describe it as nihilistic, but there's an interest in things like serial killers and dictators?
Okay, so first, before I answer, I just want to comment really quickly on what we were just talking about. But open borders, Gangster Bolshevism. So basically, my history with them is that I met Ed Bryman and Daryl Basarab through my buddy Alex Hakkinen. So I've been sort of like peripherally affiliated with them for a few years now, actually. To be honest, I don't really know if it has a coherent like political theory behind it. But I like it that it sort of champions the marginalized and disenfranchised people who've sort of been pushed by their fellow man into playing the role of, you know, the murderers and psychopaths.
Yeah, we just did a show on the film Taxi Driver and also the film Mishima, and both of those movies are about kind of the people that you're referring to. And Robert and I have basically been taking the ideology of, like, aristocratic individualism. There's people who break off from the system and try to create their own world.
Well, the thing about that aristocratic individualism, it's not so much like a just generic anarchism or libertarian, everyone just kind of does what they want. It's about these people who are outside of society, but they have this very clear vision of what their ideal society should be.
Okay, so my stance on that is that, like, to be honest, it sounds a little bit like ego protection, like, you know, constructing a fantasy reality, you know, Man in the High Castle, where you're sort of pondering the denizens of the lowlands, the plebes, and imagining a perfect world, a perfect society. In my mind, I'm fundamentally a pragmatist. So, like,
You can be an aristocratic individualist philosophically, but you can still also at the same time be a pragmatist role of the state and the role in politics.
That's true. So what does it mean to be then an aristocratic individual? It means to sort of be a spectator and also perhaps be pragmatically interacting with society?
Yeah, I mean, we also, on like a political level, describe ourselves as being radical centrists. So
I like that designation, by the way.
Oh,
radical
thank you.
Centrist, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's, or extremist moderate could be the other.
You could put me behind that. I'm down for that.
Okay. The other one we're still working on.
Yeah, only radical centrist.
We only have one show in on aristocratic individualism, but we will figure that one out. But radical centrism we've been doing for a while, so I mean that's what
aristocratic individualists are what we are in private, and like radical centrists are to the normies.
Yes, I can get behind that. That sounds I'm down for that.
Yeah, that's the accurate. That's definitely Robert Trey on that one.
We're all privately aristocratic individualists.
Yes, exactly. Like in this is our little high castle in which we talk about our Machiavellian ideas.
Yes.
And then once we go out to the public, we're radical centrist. And
That's a very good dichotomy because, I mean, radical centrist, that's an extremely rhetorically powerful designation. Like that's good branding.
You have this blog called The Acid Right. Can you talk about the philosophy? You do kind of get into the use of LSD and acid and the effects that it has on creativity, and you definitely recommend it. But is there like a philosophy behind the whole concept of an acid right?
So, I mean, I sort of created that blog as maybe like the linchpin or hub, which sort of unites my entire body of thought in my web presence. The term acid right, I just sort of took a little bit arbitrarily because my buddy Alex Hakkinen started using it. And it sort of loosely is descriptive, and it lampoons the alt-right. But for me, like LSD isn't really a central aspect of it per se, although I will say that, LSD is I try to put on multiple faces because I really despise the way, ideologies break off into binaries. You know, like people think that LSD is intrinsically, sharp left turn, shit lib bullshit. But realistically, even if you ignore the utility of taking hallucinogens, LSD, this mind space, is where the ideology which we're suffering under, which we're opposing, this is where that ideology was born. It was the role of LSD in shaping modern liberalism, in shaping anti-racism is central.
Well, Alex,
that doesn't mean that they have an exclusive ownership on it. They utilize
exactly.
Groups utilize it to enlighten themselves as well.
Well, I
agree. So I'm not saying, I'm not proposing it simply to try to infiltrate or, try to, spy on their mind space, which led to anti-racism. I think even in its own right.
Your book cover, Polar Racist in Exile, has a kind of a psychedelic aesthetic.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, because LSD has played a very strong role in my intellectual development, the shaping of my ideas.
Can you give a specific example of like an acid trip that gave you great intellectual inspiration?
Yeah, so I will tell you one specific one. But first, let me just say that taking LSD, one effect it has on me is it makes me accept my fate. Whenever I trip, for a few months after, I'm very depressed. I might not try to get laid. I might not drink alcohol. I might stop eating meat. And this depression, this resignation is extremely powerful because it makes you accept your incumbent duties in life. And moreover, for me, it sort of dissolves the wall between the ego and the world, you know. It sort of dissolves the us versus them narrative, which I see as being sort of like the scourge of our ability to proactively interface with and bridge the semiotic gap between us and anti-racist opposition. So yeah, influential trips I've had. I remember at like a rainbow gathering in Hungary, I had a very powerful trip. It was an extremely hippy-dippy experience. I was on acid and, you know, naked in the woods for like 2 weeks with a bunch of other random people. Mostly, you know, liberals and societal dropouts and freaky people. Another very powerful trip was, I remember I was working on something with my friend Alex, and I think he dosed me with DMT without knowing it. So I thought I was dying. I thought somebody maybe shot me in the back of the head. And I literally thought I died, and I felt like I was experiencing the sum total of, you know, sentience in the universe, you know, human sentience, animal sentience, sentience of inanimate matter. And it was a very heavy experience.
Are you familiar with Ernst Jünger?
That's the guy that wrote the World War One book.
Yeah.
I've heard of.
You've heard of him?
Refresh my memory though. I forget exactly.
Well, he is. He did a lot of. Wrote Storm of Steel was the book he wrote, and
I've heard of it.
He was a German soldier in World War One, and then he ran away and served in the French Foreign Legion, and I think he had said things like the natural state of man is war, and reading about Jünger through Keith Preston, you know, that's how I know about Ernst Jünger is through Keith Preston's writing on him.
Keith Preston, he writes on what, Countercurrents?
AttackTheSystem.com.
Okay, I've seen his name written.
He's a pan-secessionist anarchist. We've had him on a bunch of times. And
okay.
I mean, it's funny. Well, Preston has talked about experimenting with LSD in his younger years as well. I think a lot of people who think in this dissident way have actually had hallucinogenic experiences. But Jünger actually, you know, he was like a man sort of outside of time, just sort of serving in the army that he could join, basically. And
I dig that. That's cool.
Coming from like who was the guy who invented acid?
I think Albert Hoffman.
Yeah, he and Albert Hoffman would meet up every few years and take acid together.
I did not fucking know that.
Yeah, and they did it. They both did it till they died. And Jünger like died at the age of like 102. And they both, you know, and the thing is, Jünger is someone who people who talk about aristocratic individualism will often bring up him as an example.
And he was a hired gun.
Yeah, but it's like a hired gun of the, you know, yeah, exactly, like an outlaw, sort of a man out of time. And I find it funny that, you know, LSD, you know, if you look at this guy, you wouldn't think he was an acid head or something. But that LSD was something that went throughout his life. Yeah.
Yeah. And on that note, I should say that, you know, back to the topic of white nationalists and stuff, you know, spurning things like LSD. The thing is, they often feel like if they, you know, break through the us versus them narrative, they think all of a sudden overnight they're going to become, you know, Kool-Aid drinking shit libs. Whereas in reality, you can interact with people of all races and, you know, do LSD and understand the importance of minimizing human suffering for everybody and not seeing life as some us versus them competition.
Yeah, isn't one of your videos, it's about, like, co-opting I think it's co-opting empathy or co-opting...
Yeah, that's definitely A, because A, in terms of moral signaling, you know, it conveys power and authority if you don't see other people as enemies and try to help them. You know, that's... If you give a lot of money, that means you must be a rich man, you know? And on a side note, sorry, Alex, you were talking about this guy...
Ernst Jünger.
Keith Preston.
Oh, Keith Preston,
Keith Preston. So and this is a little pet peeve of mine. I feel that, you know, the whole Balkanization scenario, you know, like pan-secession, I feel like that way of thinking is utterly counterproductive. I feel like it's confabulatory. in order to basically justify inaction. Because what if there never is a collapse? It seems like the strategy among everybody in this greater movement, you know, white nationalism or new reaction, their strategy is to basically sit and wait until, you know, the dollar collapses or some shit. And then it's going to be like Turner Diaries and we all start shooting black
people. I think
it's never going to happen.
I think that way of thinking is a way that certain people think, and that might be an older way of have some.
It's confabulatory.
Well, yeah, that's definitely not me on any level. I think for me and for a lot of people who maybe like me, it's all about what perspective do you choose to see the world from? And once you have that perspective, then you make judgments on what is presented to you from that perspective. And then that's how you can make things change. I mean, that's how things changed over the last 50 years.
Can you repeat this again, please?
So this is basically how things changed even over the last 50 years, is that people's minds changed. And it changed the way that they changed the way they saw the world. And they changed their perspective. So when things were presented to them, they judged it from that perspective. And everything is about
they see reality in terms of their perspective, their worldview.
Exactly. And there was a worldview that was foisted upon them, and they all adapted to it. And now what we're seeing is the final remnants of the failure of that, you know, the pushing that way of thinking just pushed upon these people or us, everyone.
Anti-racism,
or just like global technological humanism, you know, totalitarian humanism, you know, this kind of forced oneness, all this stuff is forced upon people. And now we're starting to see the reaction and the way the reaction
is definitely a reaction, like shit's happening, man.
Yeah. And the way that
you had an interesting comment that you said, while you don't support positive eugenics, you feel that we ought to not try to evolutionary reward genes that are fundamentally maladaptive to evolutionary pressure, which otherwise rewards pro-social deferential traits.
Yes.
And you say the meek will inherit the earth. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so basically I feel that, you know, it's famous, you can't really predict the future, but I feel that if you observe human history and the changes in evolutionary pressures, the changes in hurdles that we must leap over in order to survive and procreate, to pass on our genes, it seems like we can sort of deduce a certain evolutionary trajectory. With anti-racism, it seems that we identify the most maladaptive traits by color, by skin color, and then confabulate this theory about why these traits are actually superior, and we reward them, but with, you know, special standards, privileges, et cetera. I feel like, you know, like the people I see myself as a very not meek person. I'm an egotistical, narcissistic motherfucker.
That's why you're an aristocratic individualist.
that's why I'm the fucking final Negro, man. Like, I'm antisocial in certain ways, but I observe these people around me, some of them who have no opinions of their own. They go along with the crowd. They're like sheep. And I see that, you know, they might be tricked into not reproducing, and they might be tricked into, you know, self-nullifying or abnegating their egos or whatever, or sacrificing their lives for, you know, the greater good or whatever. But these people, if they are within a certain society, maybe traditional society, which safeguards their interests and induces them to reproduce, they prosper in this society. And I feel that they will therefore inherit the earth. Like that's where there's many disadvantages to being such a person, but there are many fucking advantages in deep evolutionary time in human history.
What are such advantages?
I mean, honestly, for one thing, like they don't, they're not political dissidents. They don't rock the boat. They don't upset the leader. They don't upset the king, and therefore they get rewarded with mates and stuff. They're also smarter in certain ways. They maybe have more capacity for abstract cognition. They believe in God more intuitively. They believe in numbers. They may be better at fucking math and keeping up with their homework and sucking dick to get by, kissing ass to get by. And they're not too lost in their own narcissistic bullshit.
Yeah, I think there's basically like four main groups in society. There's like the aristocratic individuals, and I guess we kind of fall into that group.
We're Faustian.
Yeah. Then there's the people you talk about, you describe as the meek. They're just the sort of regular middle class, like
the normies, the sheep
who play by the rules. Then there is like the lumpen proletariat, like the gangbangers and the kind of dregs of society. And then there's the sort of parasitic class, which kind of exploits the masses, that group you describe as being the meek.
Yes. So first of all, I would like to say two things. First of all, I'm always skeptical of typology, because it's sort of, you know, we're trying to categorize and break things down into manageable bits, whereas reality is much more complex.
I agree. Not everyone has a combination of different traits, but sometimes I think in some cases, like, and as an individual, people have a combination of traits, but
yes,
you do have to look at your groups.
There's utility. Yeah, but let me just say that I think that we all sort of find niches. Whatever, we all look for a niche vocation in society, so maybe we arbitrarily choose. Then again, let me say one thing about the meek again. Fundamentally, and this is sort of my criterion for defining what is meek, but you know the prisoner's dilemma, right?
Yeah. It's like in Batman, Dark Knight, there's a great example of it.
Yes.
With the boat. It's a really good example.
I feel like the meek are the ones who are able to understand that cooperation in the long run will statistically trump competition. I sort of went back on a little
prisoner's dilemma.
So what were we talking about before? I just sort of detoured there, didn't I?
Well, that's an interesting thing to talk about. So the meek are in prisoner's dilemma. It's basically how many people are involved in it? Two, right? It's two people.
Two. So it's in the simple form, yeah.
So two people go and commit a crime. They get caught, and then the detective throws them in two separate rooms, and they have a dilemma, which is, do I admit to the crime, or do I say that guy did it, or the other guy did it? And if they both admit to the crime, then they both go to jail, and they serve a limited amount of time, and they get out, or whatever. But if one guy goes with that option, and the other guy says he did it, then he gets off free, and the other guy just goes to jail.
Yes.
So, yeah, and then if they both say he did it, then they both go to jail, and they go for longer or something. I don't know.
They go for longer. They go for longer if they both accuse each other.
Exactly, yeah.
But basically, the wisdom is that, you know, if you do it enough times, the net punishment for both people is minimized if they cooperate with each other and don't rat on each other.
Yeah, if they stick to their story and they don't rat each other out.
And this is true. This is applicable to, you know, all of human history. If we work together and cooperate, you know, we maximize value and survival for all of us.
You have been traveling around the world, all over Europe and Asia. Can you talk about the different countries you visited, some of your observations on those countries and their cultures, your experiences, and do you have like some favorite and least favorite countries?
So I've been to before my travels, I was in Israel for a year and a half and Egypt. And then since I left the US,
I've actually heard that if you go to one of those countries, you're sort of blacklisted from the other. Is that true?
If you go to Israel, you're not permitted into many Muslim countries. But if you get your passport stolen and get a new one, then you're starting from scratch. And then you can go to, Syria or whatever. But I will say that, you know, I've been to on these travels, and I've been traveling for like 4 years now, year and a half in the U.S., you know, riding freight trains and all that. And then for the past 2.5 years, most of Europe and most of Asia – I would say that I mean, my experiences sort of depend on how I my own circumstances. If you're maybe wondering about observations of, like, you know, race and culture, I would say, yeah, there's definitely, you know, most of the predictable stereotypes are, you know, approximately true. Like, you know, the further south you go, the crazier things get. The further north you go, the more stable and, you know, harmonious things are. Although, obviously, there's tons of fucking exceptions. In Asia, it's a little bit different because I think, don't quote me, but, like, there's a huge divide, obviously, between, like, the Indian subcontinent and, like, you know, East Asia. That's a very pronounced, prominent divide. For example, in India, you know, as soon as you go into Tibetan country, the people stop cheating you.
They stop cheating you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It could be caused by them having historically more mutually beneficial contacts with Western tourists. Because, well, you know, as you know, the Tibetans thing... have... sorry?
Oh, I was going to say, people do have, you know, their own moral systems and value systems. Like, that guy, Kurt Doolittle, will go on about this, you know, like... The English English have an interest in moral truth or whatever, and this group has an interest in lying and blah blah blah. And you can
Who's Kurt Doolittle? He's an HBD guy.
No, he's a guy who has developed a system called propertarianism. He's based in Kiev, Ukraine. He's a guy who's worth friending on Facebook. I don't agree with everything that he says.
His name is Kurt Doolittle.
Kurt Doolittle, but he's really pompous, super aristocratic. He sort of considers himself to be like a king or a god or something.
Sounds like my type of guy.
And he's really, he's really fun, yeah. He's worth checking out. He's a goofy guy.
What were your observations on China and Mongolia and some of the Central Asian countries?
I mean, most of what you'd expect to be is true. I feel that, you know, many HBD people, they have this sort of, I think, demented idea, which is totally false, and I can make very good arguments against it. But have you heard of, like, the what is it called again? But basically this idea that, you know, only white people of Western Europe have the capacity for effective empathy.
Oh, pathological altruism.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, they talk about
there's
that.
There's pathological altruism, and then there's just sort of basic human decency. Two different things.
They think that it's basically genetically hardwired into, you know, Western European brains. I feel that rather it's simply a function of intelligence, you know, raw, like, you know, fucking brain mass or something. Because Asians, they don't really cheat you so much.
So you're not talking about India. You're saying there's a difference between South Asia and, like, East Asia.
In East Asia, like Mongolia and China, like. Sometimes they try to cheat you, but they're usually more straight shooting, I think, for whatever reason.
Well,
inflating factors.
You know, not to sound like some kind of leftist college professor here, but it might be due to culture of certain people, and I don't mean that in a way that negates the other stuff. But I do think, you know, culture is really important when you're dealing with things like honor and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
And honesty.
Yeah, of course.
I think, you know, you're going to have HBD components to it, but I think culture is going to be
sure,
a big part
of course.
Of it.
I totally agree. And that's what I was saying with Tibetans. I'm wondering if maybe, like, they've had, like, much more positive interactions historically with Westerners and therefore don't really see Western tourists as competing entities and rather see us as friends who will... in more subtle ways, aid their cause.
Well,
it's definitely
possible. Sure. I mean, I remember being in high school, and when you're younger, I think if you have a certain kind of mindset, you kind of have a hunger to, like, be involved or something, or to have some kind of higher thing to, like, strive for. And I remember researching Tibet a lot in high school or early college.
Yeah.
And the whole thing there, you know, you have the Tibetan people who are essentially being replaced by the Chinese people. Like, the Chinese are taking over Tibet by ethnically displacing them. And when I read about that, I was like, okay, well, I'm certainly on the side of the Tibetans. You know, and this is, like, a really left-wing perspective,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, free Tibet, you know, these people are being ethnically squashed. Wait, but Robert.
It's not
Yeah.
It's ethnic self-determination. Well, even though it's being promoted by the left.
That's where I'm going with this. Is like,
yes,
that was my perspective from this like hippie left-wing, you know, kid playing rock music kind of perspective. Was like, these people need to be preserved. Their culture should be preserved. Their being should be preserved. And then I see, you know, and that's where I've kind of kept that in me. And when I see your videos on YouTube, and you have some videos where you've said, like, these hippies, these musicians, these artist types, they're us. They just haven't realized this. And when I look at the alt-right and I see all these, like, gamer nerds and these, like, neutered suburban husbands talking about their fucking grill and shit, and I'm like, you know, maybe I'm like, I can get down with you on some level, but they're not my people. On a cultural level. And then when I saw your video and you're like, these hippies, these other people, I think once their mind goes in this direction, it's like they're authentically us. They're the ones who are actually us.
And so let me say something. First of all, I think that, you know, to end the anti-racism, we don't need to mobilize the fucking conservative white middle class. We need a revolutionary class of people who are above the din, who are like fucking hippies, man. Like, not these people who were making fun of, you know, the salt of the earth. Have you heard of Dave Bryson of Evolve Fest?
What is that? Isn't that a music? I think it's like a music fest. And he made some. I have a friend who's involved in that kind of music. Yeah, and he's kind of weird.
Okay, so Evolve Fest is in New Jersey.
I'm a Jersey guy.
When I was in Rutgers, I sort of was familiar with it. It's sort of like a, you know, hippy dippy new age neo shaman sort of thing. But basically, the guy who started it, Dave Bryson, who I've spoken with on Facebook, he's a cool guy. He basically went from being the leader of this to basically hard right turn, like basically Hitler apologist, like a. You should actually get him on the show, I think. He'd be pretty good to have.
Yeah, we'll talk to him.
Yeah, David Bryson of Evolve Fest. Add him on Facebook. Talk to him. He's a cool dude.
I will.
I want you to talk about your book, Death to the World. But it's a fiction novel, but it's inspired by your travels by rail across the United States.
Yes.
You were telling me a story about your trip to SF. I was recently there. In San Francisco, and your experience—you had this interesting experience in Golden Gate Park.
Yeah, I just remember. So my novel is sort of like a hacked up reinterpretation of experiences I've had, emotions I've felt, people I've met.
Kind of reminds me of one of those like '90s Zine series.
Zion story. That. But yeah, so I remember I was in Golden Gate Park smoking meth with homeless people, and I remember this like black guy who like had like this big gap between his front teeth and like a homeless man fro. He was rapping at me about how he like castrated somebody once, which we didn't record this when we talked before earlier.
No.
Okay, yeah. So my novel, yeah, fucking A. Yeah, so it was written inspired by my travels in the U.S., inspired by my experiences like fucking fleeing terrible situations. But the novel's pretty good. It's an interracial racist love story. It's sort of like I see it as like a Trojan horse to, you know, if I can reach a certain critical threshold of readership in the alt-right, maybe I can fucking breach into mainstream normie lit circles, because this novel is sort of finely tuned to subtly thaw the hearts of the normie. It's about this guy who he's sort of, you know, modeled after myself a little bit, who basically, you know, drops out of university and he's expelled from university for, you know, thought crime, for basically putting his neck out for a schizophrenic racist friend who got the book thrown at him on trumped up charges of, you know, racially motivated assault. And so the main character gets expelled from university, hits the rails because he's, you know, he either has to take mandatory diversity training and, you know, become an economic slave because his student loans got revoked or called back, rather, or he just hits the rails, gets a face tattoo, and fucking quits this corrupt dystopian society.
Well, I'm thinking that you should send this piece of literature out to mainstream publications.
Is this a self-published book or do you have a publisher?
No, self-published.
I think that you can bypass the scene politics because those people, they're all looking at the mainstream and they're taking like what they see as representing them from the mainstream. And I think the mainstream is like looking for, and the thing is like they can take you and they can like totally criticize you.
Yeah,
but like what I was saying before about perspective is there are so many people who are on our wavelength. There's something close to it, you know.
Yes, but they don't. They will find them at this wavelength. You have to meander in conversation.
Well, but this is what I'm
getting like low wave thought. This is not in public discourse.
Well, what I am saying though is that within public discourse, what happens is it's all propaganda. Every single thing, it's getting to a point where it's overdrive. The level of propaganda is almost ridiculous. And
it's absurd.
And when I've made jokes to friends or sort of like just even hinted that there could be another way of seeing things, and they look at television, they look at newspapers, all of a sudden they see all of those things as propaganda for with the perspective you're putting out. All of a sudden, you become vindicated by every single piece of mainstream media because it's backing up your like what you're saying.
Yes, and one thing I've noticed is if I'm able to carry myself in a certain like morally laudable manner, I'm sometimes able to guide conversations even with groups of people and get these otherwise, you know, anti-racist rank and file normies get them to basically go on board. If I finesse them the right way and don't violate, you know, the rules of social proof. I say what's, you know, nice. I say it all in a nice way, but present my argument in a humble, objective, self-skeptical way.
You speak their language. You're speaking their language.
You speak in their – yes, you speak in terms of their language, in terms of their values. You can bring conversations towards, you know, basically condemning anti-racism, but it's very delicate. So do you have any publications you might recommend?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a lot of places on, you know, alternative right spheres and just dissident politics in general that would be probably interested in reviewing you. And, you know, I'm sure you know all of those places. But what I'm saying
is... Yes, although if you have connections, by the way, please feel free to...
Sure.
I would suggest Nine Banded Books, like they published Paul Bingham's work.
I am going to email that guy. The thing is, I basically self-publish. I still retain the publication rights. So basically, what I want to do is get enough of a footing in the alt-right sphere, and then use that to basically perhaps pivot off of, and maybe thereafter get published by a mainstream publisher.
Well, you do have something about you that is a bit more universally appealing than a lot of alt-right people.
That's the whole goal.
You do have this. Like, you don't seem like some ex-libertarian nerd that's resentful that the libertarian principles could only exist in a white ethno-state. You seem like someone who has a unique perspective on the world.
Thank you.
And I do think that, you know, I'll go and try to see, like, you know, if I can make some people review your work or it's weird. But dude, I honestly think
do you want to get into the plot of the book briefly, or would you rather kind of keep that a mystery for the viewers?
The plot?
Or I guess you could talk briefly about the love story.
Okay. So first let me just say one thing, and that's that basically, like, for me, the book is inseparable from my life and my ideas. Not that it's some Randian, you know, monstrosity. So the book, it's very intimate to me. And in terms of publishing, I don't want to make a career as a novelist. I just want to use this to further discussion and eventually get into, you know, nonviolent direct action in the public, aimed at, you know, forcing the conversation in public, in broad daylight,
basically in like, you know, a situationist style, like some kind of culture jamming. 100%. That's what I was talking about before, about, you know, switching their propaganda and making it ours, essentially. It's like culture jamming.
100%. Co-opt radical empathy, man.
Yeah.
How does the character meet the girl in the story?
Okay, that's a very good question. Okay, this is – we can talk about this. So I remember I was in – this was back in the earlier part of my travels. I remember in California I was on this like punk hippie bus. And we'd sort of get off in cities, like maybe 20 of us, split into groups and either dumpster dive or beg for beer money or beg for petrol for the bus. I remember one time me and these two other guys – one of the guys was black actually. We got drunk behind this dumpster. And these, like, three, like, dumpster sluts, these, like, teenage girls who were, like Afro-Hispanic or something, they came and because they saw us behind the dumpster drinking, and they were, like, fucking, like, shaking, nervous, like, talking to us, and, like, offering us cigarettes, like, shaking. And it was totally a sort of situation where, like, we could have just fucking, like, you know, like, groped them or something. Then the bus started driving off with us, so we had to run and like left them behind. But basically in the novel, this I wrote this into the plot as this is where the male protagonist meets the female protagonist, because I tried to write it in sort of a gender neutral, not gender neutral, I shouldn't say that, but I tried to give
you can people, you're allowed to use leftist terms. It's okay.
No, I try. Well, no, it's inaccurate though. I try to give equal stage time to the male and female protagonist, because it's a fucking love story. I want it to appeal to men and to fucking 45-year-old women who will, you know, buy the book and, you know, review it and shit. But basically, like, the male protagonist meets the female protagonist behind a dumpster, because the female protagonist is being sort of dragged around by her dumpster slut, like, hoop earring wearing, tequila from her dad stealing girl. And she meets him and she's like, yeah, you know, my mom was a fucking mentally unstable mud shark. I hate this town. I hate this small fucking town filled with closed-minded normies. You're a freight rider. That's so fucking cool. I want to run away with you. And then they run away the next morning.
Interesting. So
can you explain the title, Death to the World?
Yeah, so it sort of popped into my head during a fateful night in Odessa, Ukraine, maybe 2 weeks after I left the U.S. I sort of got really drunk in Odessa because I realized my plan to be a war journalist in Ukraine was not going to work, because in Donbass, I almost got kidnapped. So in Odessa, I got really drunk, and then I had this like all of a sudden my year and a half of traveling broke in the U.S. sort of just like – rained down on me, and the word death, the world in all caps, in one word, just sort of like entered my mind. But for me, it's sort of like symbolic of, you know, rejecting the material world, transcending over, you know, the bullshit of life and the bullshit of fucking human history. So for me, it's sort of an uplifting title, I think. It sounds dark to some people, but it's, for me, it's like fucking, it's triumphing over, you know, the conditions of life.
Well, I mean, I view you in a lot of ways like a hippie, you know? Are you familiar with, like, do you know Robert Taylor from the band Changes?
I've never heard of Robert Taylor or Changes.
They're a group from the late 60s, sort of post-apocalyptic neo-folk kind of thing, but Taylor's a guy who's worth looking into. Interesting. And, you know, like, there's this idea I view of the dark...
Interesting.
Yeah. There's this idea that I see.
Well, check it out.
I call it like the dark hippie, and you have the kind of
dark hippie. I mean, I don't like.
Well, I mean, I'm just using that as a kind of as a dialectical term against, you know, what we, this thing we always see.
Yes,
it's just,
yes,
you know,
gotcha,
just,
gotcha,
just,
gotcha,
it's
yeah,
the
it
opposite.
It sounds like dark enlightenment, which I think is. Really
yeah, true. Yeah, it's not like that. It's like what I see is that, you know, you have this universalist, global technological, materialist kind of want to buy the world a Coke corporate hippietism that was presented in the late 60s, You know, this kind of like, let's give it all up and go to this thing. But, you know, and it was ultimately fake. And people like Frank Zappa or the cartoonist Al Capp kind of presented sharp criticisms of it. And they were like, this is bullshit. Hippies are shit. And it was true. But the thing is, there was a legitimate other side to it, which was almost like the Manson side of hippiedom or the Robert Taylor side
which
of it.
And I got totally sort of edited out of history.
Yeah, and that is the way that I view you. You know, I view you as sort of.
Even I remember on the show, Rabbit was making this point that a lot of these 60s counterculture icons ended up making like politically incorrect statements later on.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Famously, all of them did because they were free thinkers. They were living free. They weren't you know. Political zealot ideologues who, you know, are obsessed with saying the right thing. They were free-thinking drug users and, you know, experimental livers, you know?
Oh, definitely.
You have an upcoming work coming out. Do you want – well, we can talk about that on our next show, but if you want to introduce that briefly, you can go ahead.
You mean the one I'm releasing in like a month?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, so basically after the dust starts to settle from my novel, I want to spend the next 6 weeks really figuring out how to promote it and, you know, get the word out and shit. But then I'm going to be releasing, to keep the momentum up, a compilation of my play, a compilation of my plays that I wrote during university. I was telling Alex about this actually, but at Rutgers I studied physics, but then sort of in the second half I started writing and producing avant-garde racist plays, which the university gave me money for because they didn't know the actual content of my plays. But I put one of them on successfully at Rutgers about the racist schizophrenic. But I wrote three in total, or maybe three and a half, but I'm going to publish them.
Awesome. And you also mentioned something about releasing an essay around the time of the National Policy Institute convention.
Yes. So then I wrote in Ukraine also, when I first left the U.S., I wrote sort of like what basically amounted to a manifesto, basically codifying my reaction against American Renaissance and against the alt-right. That was back in 2014. But it had basically no audience because I was sort of I intentionally – insulated myself from the alt-right internet movement until kind of recently for the sake of generating my own intellectual diversity, which is perhaps why I think what I do now.
Good idea.
Yeah, I think it was a good idea because we need, you know, new ideas because we're
obviously
not going anywhere.
You don't want to be in an echo chamber. You don't want to be in an echo chamber.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. But yeah, it's sort of a manifesto. I don't think anybody read it. Maybe one person read it actually.
Elliot Rodger.
True. But I'm going to release it, I think, around NPI. And it's sort of.
Are you going to NPI?
I am, yeah. I already bought a ticket and everything. And
you
I
are?
A ticket and I'm going,
I saw you on Red Ice Radio. It was amazing. You were sort of.
Yes.
Because what I like about you is that you sort of. You have the ideas, you have the identity, and you're coming from the right angle, but you're willing to even make fun of people on your own side in a way. And then when you popped up on Red S Radio, it seemed like you had this kind of goofy gesture spirit about you. Maybe you didn't do it intentionally, but you have this thing.
You said something about, like, you were kind of trolling them and saying maybe our whole world is just like a Nazi simulation.
Oh, yes, that was hilarious.
Yeah, so, okay, so basically, like, I did that to try to, you know, I didn't want to, you know, start learning out info about my novel. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to sort of say what they would maybe want to hear or find interesting. So I tried to sort of play the globalist finger pointing sort of thing. But that was actually that my play, my third play, was about these people who like start to think that we're in a Nazi computer simulation.
Oh, so that was your play, but you kind of
that was basically
put it out there like it was reality, and they're probably thinking like, "Who is this crazy schizophrenic?"
Well, the cool thing was is that you had a couple YouTube commenters on your video saying the absolute madman, he did it. And what I loved about that was it was almost signifying that there was like a new wave coming. Like Robert and I, and we've had Brandon Adamson, I know you reviewed Beatnik Fascism. We've talked about this idea of the alt-right or the NRX or whomever, these types, these intellectuals, they're the beatniks. Yep. They're the beatniks. And the hippies are what's to come. And I feel you're one of the first hippies.
It's fucking happening, dude.
Yeah.
It's fucking happening.
I made this symbol, which is the Grateful Dead skull, but instead of the lightning in the middle, which even does remind me of Oswald Mosley, to be honest. But I took that out and I put a black sun in the middle of it. I'll send it to you.
I would like to see that. I would like to see that. Yeah, that's awesome.
I was just kind of saying that's the thing with the alt right. It has a purpose as kind of a wrecking ball to tear down political correctness, but at the same time, I think it also has its intellectual limitations. We have to like transcend beyond that.
I fucking 100% agree. Even within a lot of like the HBD thinkers, a lot of them sort of like they're right on certain levels, but they sort of basically devolve into white supremacism, which is, you know, not the full picture.
We are getting towards the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to put out there to our audience?
Yes, there is. So yeah, like fucking read my novel. It's not bad. It's pretty good, I think. I think it's awesome, actually. But yeah, so I'm going to NPI, and on the 20th of November in DC, I'm going to be organizing a workshop on nonviolent direct action at West Potomac Park. I'm not going to be doing anything illegal. There's not going to be any actual direct action there, but I'm going to discuss the history and theory behind it and how we can, in theory, hypothetically, you know, do it in the future. Somebody who is not me can do it.
Awesome. I will be at MPI as well.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Fucking A, man.
Yeah, and some other people we've had on the show will be there too. So I look forward to snorting lines.
Who else is going
to
be there?
You know, I'm not sure if I can tell you after the show. I don't know if certain people want
to. Tell me after.
But you know, Peter Brimelow, and we've had Peter Brimelow on our show. We've had Richard Spencer.
Yep.
And I look forward to doing Lines of Coke with you and Peter Rimlow at NPI.
hell yeah, man. Fucking A.
Hopefully, I heard Peter Rimlow has a good yayo, so I'll have to...
Yeah?
No, I'm kidding. I'm
I,
sure
I don't
doesn't...
like cocaine that much, but I would do a little bit.
I would if Peter Brimelow offered
I'll
me
do a nominal.
If Brimelow offered me a cocaine...
I'd do a nominal bit.
Yeah, I would do it if Peter Brimelow offered me cocaine, but I'm sure he doesn't do coke, so...
I prefer opiates, to be honest.
Harlan Venison, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you.
And also, thanks, Alex.
It's been great being on. And Harlan Venison, it's been great to talk to you. I think you're totally weird enough to be on our wavelength. And I'd love to have you on the show.
Thanks.
I'd love to have you on the show again in any capacity possible.
Cool, yeah, man. Amen, you too.